From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Gretchen Whitmer begins her administration by calling for bipartisan cooperation.
And I think she's trying to lay down a marker right now. Hey, I'm ready to reach out. We are going to work together.
Plus, the not always glamorous history of the governor's residence.
Governor Granholm and her family, during the renovations, had their dinner served on a picnic table in the garage.
A call for more state oversight of homeschooled students.
We're not talking about making life harder for the responsible homeschooling parents. We're talking about catching the cases where parents are abusing the homeschool law and using it to harm children.
And giving kids the tools to know when to confide in grown-ups, good secrets and bad secrets. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and Happy New Year. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. New year, new governor, new cabinet, new legislature. Let's talk about the New Year's Day inauguration of Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer and review lame duck, what did and did not clear former Governor Snyder's veto pen. We turn to Zach Gorchow from Gongwer News Service and Michigan Radio's Zoe Clark. Happy New Year, you two.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
All right. Well, let us start out with that chilly swearing in on the steps of the state capitol. Here is our 49th governor calling for bipartisanship.
We might live in divisive times, but Michigan's problems are not partisan. Potholes are not political, or better skills, or great schools for our kids.
Zach, what stood out for you from Governor Whitmer's inaugural address?
I think the extent to which she's cognizant of how hard a time the Republican legislature gave former Governor Granholm in her first few years as governor. It really was a difficult situation for the new governor then. And I think she's trying to lay down a marker right now. Hey, I'm ready to reach out. We are going to work together. She's already doing meetings with the bipartisan legislative leadership. That she, you know, as someone who has served in the legislature, who was there during the Granholm era, I think she is going to do everything she can to legitimately reach out to the Republican leadership in the legislature, but also to make it clear to the public, hey, I may be the governor, but, you know, the other party is in charge of the legislature and it's going to take cooperation to get it done. I'm ready to cooperate. So, you know, wink, nod. If you start hearing about clashing in Lansing, you know, it's the other people.
Right. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Zach is just so right on. And also, I mean, she's been doing that since day one. The morning after she won, she held a press conference that basically was exactly that, continuing to extend this sort of olive branch. She also, throughout this crazy lame duck, really was not overly vocal, didn't do a lot of throwing lobs, whereas, you know, she could have, especially legislation that was, you know, talking about stripping power from her. So I think that she absolutely, and this goes back to what Zach said, because of her more than a decade in this, you know, Capitol building, knowing that this is sort of the table she has to set. Now, whether the table stays beautiful and folks live up to this bipartisan word is something completely different.
And that makes me wonder, as we all know, Republicans still in control of the state legislature. How likely are we to see this bipartisan cooperation and not legislative punching and counterpunching? I mean, are GOP leaders talking like they're open to this cooperation?
Well, I mean, we've got, two new leaders of both the state House and Senate. Now, they are both folks who have been in the House and the Senate for years, but we've got two new leaders. So we will see how they decide to work with this Democratic governor. And we will see the ability, the political ability that Governor Whitmer has. I mean, I think a lot of people will say, look, she is as politically experienced, more so than Jennifer Granholm was when she took office. Certainly more so than Rick Snyder. I mean, probably not the political experience since John Engler, at least knowing this town. And so we will see whether she can bend them to her will. But look, there are divisive issues. Road funding. I mean, just to name one. I mean, Republicans aren't going to raise taxes, you know, in these legislatures. So this is what we're going to be watching.
And we've got this whole new leadership team in place. Are there surprises for either of you in Governor Whitmer's cabinet picks? Zach, what do you think?
Well, I don't know about I mean, maybe surprises. I think it was interesting that she chose someone with a clean energy background in Liesl Eichler-Clark for Department of Environmental Quality Director, as opposed to, say, a clean air or clean water person. Now, of course, she's going to create a new Department of Great Lakes and Freshwater. So maybe you get somebody from the more, you know, traditional environmental activist world that ends up running that department. You know, she made a very interesting decision on the new colonel of the Michigan State Police. There's a lot of folks out there who would say, you got to bring in somebody, you know, from the outside, that there are some problems there that are, you know, it's a pretty long list of issues that have come up with the African-American community. She opted to pick an internal candidate who is white. You know, there hasn't been a tremendous amount of backlash yet, but there was a bit of a gamble there. I mean, you know, she even, you know, when I spoke to her about it, she said she did consider the idea of bringing in an outsider, but she felt ultimately it's the ideas that will matter more. And she needs somebody whose judgment she can trust and who knows the problems of the institution in a way that an outsider might not. So those were two, I think, that maybe were a bit of a surprise.
We're talking about the new year in Michigan politics with a new governor, new cabinet, new legislature with Zach Gorchow from Gongra News Service and Michigan Radio's Zoe Clark. Let's get into what Governor Whitmer inherited from lame duck. Rick Snyder was certainly chained to his desk with plowing through hundreds of bills. Zoe, what do you think are the most significant vetoes from the former governor?
Well, I guess what I would put it in perspective is sort of right in the final sort of weeks, right, that there was so much attention on Michigan and Wisconsin, right? And these sort of Republican lame duck power grabs, all of the headlines said. And, you know, unlike Scott Walker in Wisconsin, former Governor Snyder really vetoed some of the bills that, you know, he were criticized as GOP power grabs. So I thought that was interesting in sort of his final out the door decisions that he vetoed some of these. I think that there are some probably moderate Republicans, conservatives, maybe even in some regards, conservative Democrats who would have liked to have seen this governor do some more of that over the 8 years when he was presented with bills. For example, the infamous sort of example, you know, right to work. And
yes,
it's not on my agenda, but deciding to sign it anyway.
What about you, Zach?
I mean, I think Zoe's right that there were two major issues. You could maybe even say two and a half that really antagonized the Democrats. One was the idea that the House, Michigan House or Michigan Senate, could intervene in court on anything involving a state law, widely seen as undercutting the authority of the new Democratic Attorney General Dana Nessel. And then the bills that would have moved oversight of campaign finance away from the new Democratic Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson to a independent commission. And then there was also a bill that fiddled around a little bit with the redistricting commission proposal too. And none of those ended up becoming law. The Proposal 2 piece and the Secretary of State piece never made it out of the Michigan House and died there. And then the governor vetoed the court intervention legislation. So, you know, it's interesting that Michigan really did end up on, you know, the national headlines as, you know, Republicans looking to, you know, kneecap incoming Democrats. But it did not turn out nearly the way it did in Wisconsin, because most of these things didn't become law.
Now the other side of the coin, though, what are the most important and impactful bills that Rick Snyder did sign?
Well, I think one of the real political ones, right, was changing the way that petition signatures can be gathered. And of course, after all the talk and headlines about proposals, particularly Proposal 2 and redistricting, that was interesting to watch. And also something that sort of went under the radar is a $1.2 billion supplemental spending bill that he signed.
That shifted some revenue away from the school fund.
Indeed.
What jumped out at you, Zach?
Yeah, those definitely were the two. And I should say, you know, that petition bill was definitely the third one that really antagonized the Democrats, because they're already gearing up for some petition initiatives in 2020. And this is going to make it a lot harder if it's not overturned in court. And there definitely will be a court challenge.
Yeah.
You know, the one that surprised me that he signed was the bill that says State Department directors cannot issue new regulations that are stricter than federal rules without clear and convincing evidence that it needs to be done. He had vetoed a similar bill a few years ago. A second attempt never made it out of the legislature because it was widely known he'd veto it. It definitely infringes upon executive authority. And even though they weakened it a little bit by giving the department directors this out with being able to demonstrate a clear and convincing need, it still was surprising, and it does put the incoming Whitmer administration in an interesting spot because, you know, let's say they promulgate rules on PFAS or something like that. You know, what if someone out there goes to court and says, you didn't demonstrate a clear and convincing need? I mean, there could be a lot of litigation, you know, even on some of the more mundane rules. This could be, you know, full employment act for lawyers, depending on how this shakes out.
Final jump ball question. What will you each be watching for in these early days of the Whitmer administration?
Oh, I think absolutely the relationship of the quadrant, right? So these are the legislative leaders, both the majority and minority leaders, and the new governor, Gretchen Whitmer, and how they decide to kind of have their relationship gel in the early days will likely portend for their relationship over the next 2 and 4 years.
Zach?
I think it's to what extent or do they really dig in and try to cooperate, or to what extent do they start drawing lines in the sand? Do the Republicans in the legislature just start, you know, throwing bills at the governor's desk? You know, the governor said she supports repealing the pension tax and said it can be done without any offsetting revenue. Well, that bill would probably get unanimous support in the Senate and the House. They could have that on her desk by the end of the month and really put her in a jam on what she wants to do. Does Gretchen Whitmer, the new governor, does she start just firing out all kinds of executive orders, promulgating rules, doing things to show, hey, yeah, it may take some time to get things out of the legislature, but, you know, the heck with them. I'm moving hard and fast on in other ways that I can do that.
Keeping an eye on Lansing in this new year. Michigan Radio's Zoe Clark and from Gangwon News Service, Zach Gorchow. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Cindy.
Thanks.
Coming up, a brief history of Michigan's governor's residence, which, by the way, is not a mansion.
They didn't just give the house empty. They said, you can have the house for free, but, oh, by the way, we would like you to pay for the furnishings and the artwork that we've collected.
That comes up in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's tough to quantify child abuse in this country because it's a horror that usually happens in secret, inflicted on youngsters who are threatened, don't tell or else, or youngsters who feel they caused it or they just don't know who to tell about what happened. We do know that every year more than 3.6 million referrals are made to child protection agencies involving more than 6.6 million children, and that means a referral can include multiple children. And the United States has one of the worst records among industrialized nations, losing on average between 4 and 7 children every day to child abuse and neglect. Tony McMorris and Dr. Larry Matthews want to give kids the tools to know when to confide in grown-ups, and which adults to confide in. They're doing it through a nonprofit they've co-founded called Good Secrets and Bad Secrets. Larry is a healthcare researcher for Wayne State University and an instructor at Oakland Community College. And Tony's the author of the book also titled Good Secrets and Bad Secrets with Libby the Lizard. It's good to have you both with us on Stateside. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Thank you for inviting us.
First, a bit about yourselves. Larry, you grew up in an abusive family, your father?
Yes, I did.
Tell us a little about that.
Very dysfunctional family. My stepfather beat my mother. Then he also beat the children. But he also sexually abused my sister and half-sister. And so that was the environment that I was raised in.
All right. So you have that in your background. And Tony, you were abused as a teenager?
Yes. I grew up in a pretty functional family. However, while I was in high school, I also worked a part-time job. And my boss at work lured me into his office and assaulted me. I remained quiet. I didn't tell anyone about it for more than 35 years until I wrote and published the book.
And certainly we're hearing echoes of this in headlines today everywhere. Why I didn't tell. And, and that not telling, it seems to me that is the crux of what you're getting at with this nonprofit you've co-founded. What brought you together and pointed you down the road of co-founding Good Secrets and Bad Secrets?
I met Tony through church. Tony needed someone to help her with the business plan. And our pastor was there at the church, and he was talking to Tony, and he just said, you need Larry. And the next day we met, and we just co-founded Good Secrets and Bad Secrets.
Sharing kind of common things.
Common things,
and,
yes.
And so what is the mission, Tony, of Good Secrets and Bad Secrets?
Awareness, prevention, and intervention of child abuse, bullying. And we have recently decided that it's important for us to add human trafficking as well, because there are so many children who are trafficked in this country. Human trafficking has become the second leading criminal enterprise in the world and in the United States, only second to drug trafficking.
And it's all about a young person, a child, a young teen, knowing
yes.
It's okay to tell, but tell the right person?
Exactly, to tell the right person. And that's why I like what we're doing. And then when you look at the book again, the book has a trust list in it. And through the program, then the children learn, they identify who they can trust, who they can talk to, so that if something happens to them, they can go to that individual.
What age children?
We currently have a K through second grade curriculum. However, we are going to go up to the fifth grade and eventually to high school students as well. But the early learner population is really important because we want to help them to understand the distinctions between appropriate and inappropriate behaviors so they can be empowered to protect themselves as well. And it gives the parents a tool to help discuss issues with their children also.
Now, I know you have this book that you wrote, Good Secrets and Bad Secrets, illustrated by Justin Rose. We need to give a shout out to the illustrator. But you mentioned a curriculum. So is this, are you going into classes or are you providing information to teachers? How is your work getting out there?
We get there through going into the classroom. That's one primary way that we're doing it. And we're so happy that one of the schools that we did our program with has written our program into their curriculum, actually have it in their curriculum. And they did it over an 8-week program, 3 hours per week, and it's just tremendous results that we got from that school. Got a tremendous letter from them also about how that program impacted their students.
Well, I'm wondering this. How do you measure success of what you did in a school?
The first thing we did was we had professional development with the teachers. It was important for us to have buy-in from the educators. And they were very enthusiastic because they understand that they have a population of students who fit into those statistics that you mentioned. One out of every four girls is sexually assaulted by the age of 18. One out of six boys. 160,000 children miss school every day because they are afraid of being bullied. The statistics just go on and on. So they know that their classrooms are filled with children whom, if they have not been abused, targeted for human trafficking, or bullied, that they will. Mm-hmm. And so we received buy-in from them. Now, the professional development was very successful, so we received buy-in. And then the next thing was to actually go through the content. The content meets the core standards required by the state of Michigan for social studies and reading. And Larry was talking about how we measured success. Well, we also, if you want to explain about the evaluation that we had from the University of Detroit Mercy's Dean of Addiction Studies and Counseling.
And that's one of the things that we think is very important, is to make sure that our program is on hitting the target. And so we did a contract with the Dean of Addiction Studies, and she looked at our program. She did a pretest and a post-test, and then she measured the success of our program and then gave us a report on that program. It's important for it to be a very independent study, and she gave us a very good marks on what we did with our program.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with Dr. Larry Matthews and with Tony McMorris, who co-founded a nonprofit called Good Secrets and Bad Secrets, reaching out to young children to help give them the tools to be able to recognize what is something that is bad and how to go about telling the right adult. So what are the most important tools that a child needs to know that something bad has happened and to tell the right adult?
Well, one thing is to trust your instincts or that inner ear. It's not that things that are bad always feel bad. But when you see what your parents do, when you see the positive things that happen, and you understand the rules, policies, you understand what it is to be a good citizen, then you want to model those behaviors. So teachers and parents give their children praise for doing the right thing and warn them against bad things and talk about them. And this is what happens in the classroom.
And in your book, you use a very cute Libby the Lizard. And so how does Libby teach these lessons to the youngsters?
Libby the Lizard is our mascot. It's a branded trademark. It took 9 months to get her branded. And we also have an actual mascot that was made by the parade company. So Libby interacts with the kids, and the kids really identify with Libby, especially when Libby comes into the classroom.
How does she help these youngsters kind of get this idea to communicate with each other and to talk with adults?
Well, discussing issues regarding bullying and abuse is not always easy.
It's just heavy stuff.
It is. And so we want to take the fear out of that. And by presenting Libby the Lizard, she has mass appeal. It makes it easier for the kids to understand what we're talking about, easier for them to embrace, and they're actually excited. So it is through entertaining them that they also learn. So this is sort of branding child safety, and that's what Libby the Lizard does.
And so Libby helps them understand what good secrets
exactly.
are, and then the kinds of bad secrets like stealing, not telling the truth, hurting other people, hurting yourself, bad touches.
That's right.
And then this trust list. Talk about this trust list.
Well, we talk about children telling adults when something bad happens. But having a tool to assist them in doing that is very important. So the children actually write down the names and telephone numbers. We want them to memorize numbers, but let's face it, we don't memorize numbers ourselves because we use technology for that. So we want them to have a reference tool. It's important for them to own the list. And when they sit down with their parents or teachers, whomever it is, it's for them to decide who they like and really trust and feel they can talk to about anything. I remember growing up, my mom's youngest sister would have been on my trust list because she and I were extremely close and I felt comfortable talking to her about almost anything. It's not that I didn't trust my mom, but you kind of hold mom sometimes to put her on a pedestal and you don't want to disappoint mom. But I knew that my aunt was very understanding of everything that.
So you're helping these youngsters decide who that trusted person is. And then I see in great big headlines, do not keep scary things quiet. And that's the key.
That's the key to the whole program.
Well, again, we want to thank you for sharing your work and your passion with us, Dr. Larry Matthews and Tony McMorris, the co-founders of Good Secrets and Bad Secrets. Thank you.
Thank you Cynthia.
Appreciate you.
It is the first Wednesday of 2019, and that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. January 1st ushered in a change of Michigan's governor. The beginning of Governor Gretchen Whitmer's administration is likely going to bring many new approaches to high-profile issues such as Line 5 and changes in the way our state is governed. One change that has kind of flown under the radar is the fact that the governor's family is back living in the official residence in Lansing, a home last occupied in 2010 by Governor Jennifer Granholm's family. So let's talk a little about the history of the governor's residence with State Archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. Welcome back to Stateside, Mark, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
So why is this the governor's residence and not the governor's mansion?
There's always been a call for a governor's mansion. That's pretty common in most states. It's the top official for the state, and most people think there should be a dedicated residence for that individual, but that's not always the case. There are states like New York that have a very elaborate mansion where the governor resides in Albany, but Michigan's never actually had a mansion. We have a residence.
We should say this, no mansion, but Michigan's governors get a pretty sweet summer residence, don't they?
They do. In 1945, you know, understand we were a state in 1837, but in 1945, the governor was allocated a summer residence cottage. Let's put quotes around that on Mackinac Island. So while we might not have a mansion like New York State, our governor has a summer residence on Mackinac Island. Try to beat that.
Yes, very much, very much. But were there efforts to get a mansion through the years?
So we've only had a full-time legislature since 1963. So before that, you have to set the context that this was essentially a part-time legislature, including the governor for all intents and purposes. But Austin Blair, right around the time of the Civil War, started calling for there, you know, there really needs to be an official residence for the governor. We should take this seriously. This wasn't a high-paying job. And at the very least, they should have a residence for the governor so that they could conduct business throughout the year in Lansing, even though the legislature wasn't there. And after Blair, you start seeing in the annual messages of the governors at the very end of all of their, you know, their annual speech, which is essentially the state of the state. At the end, they would reserve a little section that said, you really need to do something about this official residence. And then it really started to culminate in the 1940s after they got that summer residence on Mackinac Island. They said, well, we should have one in Lansing as well. But politically, that didn't really fly because you have veterans coming back from World War II. There was a housing shortage. There actually was a house in Lansing called the Orlando Barnes Mansion. It was a palatial Victorian mansion that was, I think it was around 17,000 square feet.
Hmm.
It had been vacant and it had been offered to the state for a dollar. And the Michigan Society of Architects did a review of the structure for feasibility, and they determined it would take about $250,000 in that ballpark to refurb it. But at the time, the governor just didn't want to spend money on one residence when he had veterans returning home without a place to live.
Bad optics. And that was a lot of money in 1945.
It was. And it's post-war. And yeah. Also, an interesting side note is the Society of Architects were led by an architect named Ken Black, and they were all influenced by Walter Gropius's Bauhaus, you know, school of design. So think East Lake Victorian and then a bunch of Bauhaus devotees. It didn't really...
Not a good mix.
I think the writing was on the wall, even if it cost $100.
So how did the governor finally get a residence?
So you have to fast forward all the way up to 1969 when a gentleman named Howard Sober, who had spent his early career perfecting automotive trailers, so those car carriers that you see on the roads,
yeah,
those were essentially invented and perfected by Howard Sober with his Howard Sober Transport Company in Lansing. And he had built a very fancy house in 1959, and he offered it to the state because he felt strongly that the governor should have an official residence in 1969 when Governor Milliken was becoming governor.
And I have actually been to this residence. It's a ranch. It's big and sprawling, and it's lovely, but it's a 50s ranch.
It is a 50s ranch.
So here we have the state of Michigan created in 1837, gets a 50s ranch house for the governor. Was there any controversy over the choice of this house?
Yeah, I think the controversy was not just over the choice of it, which was really secondary to the fact that even though Mr. Sober donated the house, there was the small hiccup of that he wanted to be paid for the furnishings and artwork collection that was in the house. So they didn't just give the house empty. They said, you can have the house for free, but oh, by the way, we would like you to pay for the furnishings and the artwork that we've collected.
And did the state pay up?
Yeah, it was in the papers. It was lots of controversy. And I think the final sum was around $210,000. But what it really spawned was this private organization of donors, of, you know, a nonprofit organization that basically administers the contents of the house moving forward. So all the governors since Milliken that have lived there have had access to this 501c3 organization that helps with things like furnishings and whatnot. The property itself is managed by the State Department of Management and Budget. But that's just the structure. The inside of it is managed by this 501c3.
Okay.
So that we don't have any use of state funds for luxury items. You know, no $100 hammers there.
Now, has this house that is the official governor's residence, has it been updated since 1959?
Yeah. When Governor Granholm was there, they went through a renovation project to update some things and also add on separate living quarters. So I don't know if when you were there that was done or not, but there was, for added security and just for some space for the first family to be, you know, cordoned off, they created an addition and updated most of the house. That famously is why Governor Granholm and her family, during the renovations, had their dinner served on a picnic table in the garage. That picnic table is now in the Michigan History Museum. But instead of, you know, they didn't want to be fawned over or given special treatment, they just took their dinners in the garage.
That's pretty great. And we know Governor Snyder took the position of thanks but no and continued to live in Ann Arbor and commute during his tenure. But now Governor Whitmer is back living there again, and yet they can still hold functions.
Yeah, so it has dual purpose now. I think it's exciting that the family's there. It was a gift to the state, and you know, we can now say we have an official residence where past governors would either have to stay in a hotel or travel from their own home. We have an official residence. While it's not as visually spectacular as some, you know, we have to remember that we have the summer residence, which is quite remarkable as well.
Thank you to our state archivist, Mark Harvey, giving us the history of Michigan's official governor's residence once more, housing a governor and family for the first time since Jennifer Granholm left office 8 years ago. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Up next, Michigan's homeschooling laws, how they work, and changes some believe should be made.
We're not talking about making life harder for the responsible homeschooling parents. We're talking about catching the cases where parents are abusing the homeschool law and using it to harm children.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In recent years, the number of American families choosing to homeschool their kids has been on the rise. Parents point to a variety of reasons for homeschooling, from dissatisfaction with the school environment to fear of school shootings. Michigan is one of 11 states which does not require any contact with state or local education officials for families who homeschool. For many homeschool advocates, this means parents have the most freedom to develop a learning environment to work for their kids. But some groups are raising alarm bells about the potential for abuse in the system. Last summer, a Lansing couple was charged with child abuse and unlawful imprisonment. Police say the couple's five children had endured years of horrific abuse before being removed from the home in 2017. Their mother had pulled them from public schools despite multiple reports and investigations by Child Protective Services, and there was no law to stop that. This week, we're going to look at Michigan's homeschool laws. Today, we hear from Rachel Coleman. She's executive director of the Coalition for Responsible Home Education. It's one of the groups pushing for stricter homeschool oversight in Michigan. And she joins us via Skype. Rachel, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you.
So how do you think that Michigan's homeschooling regulations played any role in what happened to these children? I mean, I guess I'm asking what might have been different had they lived in another state with tougher regulations?
So there are some states that require parents to have their children assessed each year, either by a standardized test or a portfolio review. That would have at least ensured that the parents would have to put some effort into educating their children and couldn't just take them out and hide them away. But unfortunately, currently, no state has any system at all for flagging cases where there was past contact with Child Protective Services that ought to have made pulling the child from school a bit of a red flag. There have actually been several attempts to create such flagging systems in recent years, and there seems to be a growing movement towards doing that. But no state so far has actually created a system of that sort.
So let's talk more about Michigan's homeschooling regulations. If I decide that I'm going to homeschool my child, what do I need to do and who do I need to tell?
Nothing and nobody.
Boy.
Technically, you are supposed to be providing what the law says is an organized educational program in the subject areas of reading, spelling, mathematics, science, history, civics, literature, writing, and English grammar. However, you don't have to tell the school district that you're homeschooling, and nobody checks to make sure that this education is taking place. If you did have your children in school before, you know, obviously you need to withdraw your children, and usually at that point you would tell the school district you are going to be homeschooling them, but there is no form, there is no list, and nobody checks in.
And if a youngster never even enters the public school system, then they just
correct.
Nothing.
They just don't send them to school. They don't need to notify anyone at all.
So Here we are talking, I think, about two separate issues. So first is the issue of safety, and second is the issue of whether homeschool kids are being properly educated. So let's start by going more deeply into the safety issue, such as these cases from Lansing and Detroit. How do the current regulations create a safety risk in your view?
Children who attend public school are seen by numerous different individuals every day, most of whom are mandatory reporters. And this also means they have access to individuals that they can reach out to if they need help, if they're having problems at home. But when children are homeschooled, who they see each day is completely up to their parents. So a responsible homeschooling parent who's really got their children's best interests in mind, those kids are being seen by coaches, you know, they're being seen by tutors or, you know, piano lesson teachers, the librarians, people at church. But there's no requirement that a homeschooling parent have their children out in the community like that. So the reality is that if a homeschooling parent decided to do so, they can just lock their kids away, like in these cases we're talking about. And then those kids not only are not seen by anyone who may notice a problem, they also don't have any safe adults in their lives that they can go to when they need help.
And in that case in Lansing, those five children were taken out of public school after Child Protective Services reports that had been filed by staff at the school. One has to wonder, is that not something that would raise a red flag to somebody?
It should, but it doesn't, because there is no current law to create a flagging system. So legally, any parent can homeschool, including parents who've been convicted of child abuse in the past, including parents who are being investigated for child abuse. So there's no way to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, maybe these kids shouldn't be homeschooled. Now, usually when this happens, there isn't an open case. It frequently happens after a Child Protective Services case is closed, because the parent then says, I don't want to have to worry about this happening again. And so then they pull the children. So these frequently, generally, they're not kids who are on anyone's radar currently, but they are kids where you can look at this trajectory and say, there should be cause for concern here. But again, there's no system for saying when a child begins to be homeschooled, these sorts of recs should be checked. Because, like I said, they're not even required to notify anyone when they begin homeschooling.
So if I was to wonder, and I am, what kind of data is being collected on kids whose families choose to homeschool them, what's the answer to that?
So there was a recent study in Connecticut, and they found that of children removed from school to be homeschooled, 36% had child abuse or neglect reports against their family in the past. And the vast majority of those were substantiated reports or cases where there were multiple reports. So that's a full third of children in these circumstances.
If you've just joined us, we're exploring Michigan's homeschooling regulations. Michigan is one of 11 states that does not require homeschool kids to have any contact with local or state education officials. And I'm speaking with Rachel Coleman, who's executive director of the Coalition for Responsible Home Education. Let's shift over to this issue of whether or not homeschool kids in Michigan are getting an education. So does the state track what kids who are homeschooled are learning?
No, not in any fashion. In fact, just this morning, we received another query from a homeschool grad in Michigan saying, I don't have a diploma. You know, the individual who homeschooled me has since died. What do I do? And the answer is, there are no state records. There are no records kept at all on kids' educations. It's completely in the hands of the parents. So if a parent doesn't, due to neglect, or if they're disorganized, or if they later pass away and haven't been careful enough with where the records are even stored, those kids can have no record that they received any education at all, which impacts the ability to get a job, to go to college, and beyond.
So let's talk about changes that could happen when it comes to how the state oversees homeschooling. And in 2015, after those two Detroit children were murdered by their mother, State Representative Stephanie Chang proposed a bill that would call for increasing oversight of homeschooling. But it didn't even get out of the House committee. And the then chair of the Senate Education Committee, who was at that time Republican Phil Pavlov, he wrote a letter saying those murders were being used, in his words, to impose new regulations on loving, committed, and law-abiding Michigan families. So what are your thoughts about that argument?
Well, for one thing, that bill, had it passed, would not have created any hindrance for those loving, committed Michigan families. All that bill would have required is that parents have their children seen by a mandatory reporter twice a year and have a form filled out by that individual. And that mandatory reporter could be a doctor, a dentist, a teacher that the person, you know, maybe a friend, or even the pastor at their church. So it, one way we like to put it, we support oversight that requires the sorts of things that responsible homeschooling parents are already doing. I actually grew up in a state that did not require anything either. It was Indiana. And my parents still created a portfolio for each of us each year. They still had us tested certain years because they wanted to make sure they were getting it right. Having to turn that into somebody or have it looked at by somebody would not have imposed a burden. So we're not talking about making life harder for the responsible homeschooling parents. We're talking about catching the cases where parents are abusing the homeschool law and using it to harm children.
Now, there are children who are abused, certainly, who attend public schools or charter schools. And there are people within the homeschool community who would say, well, why should we get extra scrutiny? I mean, why are we not addressing the root of the issue, which appears to be, especially in the Lansing case, with Child Protective Services?
Absolutely, Child Protective Services can be and should be improved. But if a child is not being seen by anybody, they can't even get reported to anybody. And we're not talking about more scrutiny than the children who go to public school. Children who go to public school are seen by multiple mandatory reporters every single day. Requiring some mandatory reporter contact for other children, that's not about singling homeschooled students out. It's about saying we have a gap in our current child protective system. We have the system that says teachers need to be mandatory reporters who can recognize abuse and report it, but we don't do anything for homeschooled children. They get to fall through that gap, and it's about filling in that gap and protecting those kids.
There is another argument put forth, and that's the fact that these instances of abuse, like the one we've talked about in the Lansing case and this Detroit case, are a tiny percentage of the families who are homeschooling. So groups like the Homeschool Legal Defense Association maintain that making regulations based on that tiny number of cases isn't the way to do this. It's to punish people when they break the law. How do you respond to that argument?
We don't actually know that it is a tiny percentage of cases. When I first started this work, I actually probably would have said that. But we've seen increasing numbers of studies, such as the one in Connecticut, that suggest that it may be more like a third of homeschooled kids where there is abuse and neglect going on and homeschooling is taking place to hide it. And so what one thing we would like to see is more data, more studies like this one in Connecticut to look at and say, is it a small percentage or is this a much bigger problem than we may think? Most people who homeschool who are doing so responsibly, they're not going to know the cases where there's horrific abuse going on because those people who are using homeschooling to hide their abuse are not turning around and enrolling their kids in homeschool co-ops. So someone who homeschools isn't necessarily seeing the problem at all or the extent of the problem. We need more data to look at and say, is it a big problem or a small problem? Because at this point, we're not sure.
Rachel, what changes would you like to see when it comes to how Michigan oversees homeschooling?
There was a very interesting bill recommended by Pennsylvania's Child Task Force, Child Fatality Task Force, some years back. The bill would have said when a family begins homeschooling, the name of the adults in the household and the children in the household needs to be submitted to the agency responsible for child welfare, so Child Protective Services. And then all that agency does is check. Has there been a substantiated case of child abuse involving these individuals in the past 18 months? And if the answer was yes, then that agency would oversee the parents for the first 6 months that they would homeschool. And then they could recommend to continue that oversight up to 2 years, just to make sure that there's nothing else going on here. This recommendation, this wouldn't have impacted families that hadn't had a founded case of child abuse in the past 18 months. But it would have caught some of these cases, like these ones we're talking about today, and it would have subjected those families to a little bit of extra scrutiny. It would have said, you know what, we need to make sure that homeschooling is actually taking place for these children's educational well-being and not as a way to hide child abuse. So we would like to see more proposals like that studied and tried in different places, including states like Michigan.
Why do you think it is so hard, Rachel, to get regulations passed around homeschooling?
When homeschooling parents think about regulations and requirements, they usually just think about their own family and their own kids. And I've had homeschooling parents say to me, why should I have to let somebody else, you know, see my kids? I know they're fine. And so what we try to encourage homeschooling parents to do is to look beyond their own family and realize we're talking about all the other kids too. And they may know their children are fine, but they can't say that about every other homeschooled child out there. So I think because homeschooling is a very individualistic thing, many parents end up having that individualistic view without realizing that we're really talking about child welfare on a much broader scale, 2 million children across the country, and not just one family's specific children.
Rachel Coleman, Executive Director of the Coalition for Responsible Home Education. Rachel, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Absolutely.
And tomorrow we hear from the other side of this debate. Mike Donnelly is an attorney with the Homeschool Legal Defense Association.
What you see is a trend across the country of actually removing restrictions from homeschooling families as opposed to increasing them. And so Michigan tends to be where most states are actually moving to.
But first, let's get some perspective from the people in the middle of this debate, homeschooling families. We reached out to a parent and advocate here in Michigan to hear about their homeschool experiences and why they think creating new state regulations would do more harm than good. First, we hear from a homeschool parent in Superior Township, and then we hear from Israel Wayne, head of communications for the state's largest homeschool association.
My name is Lindsay Hufford, and I live in Superior Township, Michigan. We began homeschooling 6 years ago when our oldest child was going into kindergarten. The year before, we just decided that we weren't ready for him to have a full day of academic learning. One of the biggest benefits we see of homeschooling is family time together. We are able to have a lot more downtime in our day from homeschooling, and they're also able to do more interest-led learning and research the topics that they really want to learn about. I'm personally not in favor of more state oversight of homeschooling. I think that, unfortunately, you are always going to have situations where parents or caregivers of children end up abusing or neglecting those children. I think that the situations in which those are homeschooling families are incredibly rare. Most of the families I know, in fact, I would say all of the families I know who homeschool their children do it because they care deeply for their children. They care for their kids' welfare. Many of my friends are homeschooling kids who would be called twice exceptional or having differing abilities. So they're kind of going above and beyond to make sure their kids' needs are met.
My name is Israel Wayne, and I am the communications coordinator for a group called Michigan Christian Homeschool Network. It's an acronym that's pronounced MISSION. It's the longest running and largest association in the state of Michigan representing home education. I think some people have a concern that if there's not a lot of regulation on homeschooling, that the students may not be learning, that they may not be progressing academically. But the research actually indicates that's not the case. We have standardized achievement tests from states all across the United States. And the research has indicated that states that are highly regulated actually have no better academic performance than states like Michigan, where there's lower. I saw an article recently in the Detroit Free Press that was advocating that homeschoolers need to be regulated because if they are in the public school system and they are known to be abusers and then they decide to homeschool, that somehow these children will disappear. The fact is that simply because a family begins homeschooling, they're not lost to the system. If Child Protective Services was involved in that family, they will continue to be involved in that family. The fact that they're home educating does not remove them from the Child Protective System if they indeed were involved in that. There are thousands of families who have taken their children out of public schools for fear of their safety. Many of them are bullied in the schools. They're afraid for their child's life with school shootings and so forth. So when you have loving parents who want to protect their children and want to keep them safe from known dangers that happen within the school system, those parents should not be viewed with high suspicion as though these parents are out to harm their children. In many cases, that's exactly why they're home educating, because they love their children and they want to provide a safe, protected environment for them to be able to flourish academically.
And again, tomorrow we'll have the other side of the debate over more state oversight of homeschooling. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scott. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Bella Isaac, Sarah Leeson, and Lindsay Scullin. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.